It wasn't just Andrew Benintendi today. It was JD Martinez, who has gotten hot.
That ball is gone! What a bullet by Devers!
I love to see the exit velocity on that one.
It is time for another edition of the wildly popular, at least in our own minds, TC and Jerry podcast, because Tom and Jerry was already taken 50 years ago or so. Tom Karen with you here at my house. Jerry Remy with us there at his house in the chair. And he joins us. Jerry, we begin each show as I check in on how you're doing. We talk from time to time, but everything going well? You feeling good?
Yeah, everything's going great, TC. I congratulations on your show. I saw it last night. Good show.
Thank you. Yeah, we're up and running at home with TC. You can see the difference now. I got a real microphone they sent me, because now that I do a show.
That's good. They set a whole studio up in your house?
Got a little studio. Got a little lighting kit, which you can sort of see the reflection of over there.
That's probably what I got to need to do games.
When they start playing games in Japan in a dome, which is what we've heard.
Yeah, I'm not going to Japan. I can pay you that.
Been there, done that, Jerry?
I've been there, done that.
You've told so many stories, and we hadn't planned on talking about this, but you know, there's baseball going on. Let's start there. Baseball is happening again in Taiwan. Have you seen any of this? Have you watched it on the line online at all?
No, I've just seen a couple of clips of it on the news and stuff like that, you know, and it looks so strange, doesn't it, without people in the stands? I mean, it really looks weird, you know, but I think that's something that we're going to have to get used to here, because it sounds like every proposal that's coming out of baseball right now, it's got to stop with no fans. And that's going to be so strange, you know. And of course, we don't know where that's going to be, how that's going to happen. But it's going to be bizarre to be sitting there watching a Major League Baseball game with no fans in the stands.
Did you see, I don't know if you saw this, one of the teams in Taiwan, they had mannequins and robots in the stands. So it didn't look empty. And so they had all these mannequins holding up pennants. Some of them were wearing face masks just to remind people. And a guy hit a home run, and they blasted the crowd cheering over the speakers. And it wasn't awful, but it felt like a Stephen King movie or something.
That's pretty good thinking. That's not a bad idea. You know, maybe we can come up with something like that. MLB's got to think about that now. They got all getting enough on their mind right now. Then they got to think about how to get crowd noise and people in the stands.
Because back in the day, you could have sold them all Rem Dog t-shirts. It would have been great. Yeah, every mannequin could have had one of the Rem Dog t-shirts.
If we have that.
You know, but we did touch on Japan, because we're talking about the baseball in Taiwan. You went with the Red Sox in 08, and you said that is still one of the most difficult trips you've ever been a part of, right?
It was. You know, in TC, what was strange about it is, you know, obviously the long flight. We left from Fort Myers and went to Chicago, and Chicago directly to Tokyo. And we weren't there for a long time. I believe it was only a four-day trip to Tokyo. And, you know, the time there wasn't bad. It was strange because, you know, you woke up in the morning and it was nighttime here the next day. And it took a while to get used to that. But the time in Tokyo was actually pretty good. You know, it was the fact coming back from there was horrible, because we came back and we had to go to L.A. to play an exhibition game against the Dodgers. And you know, the flight wasn't as long, obviously, coming back, as we stopped in L.A. And then we had to go. We restart the season in Oakland, which was strange. You know, we went from starting a season to an exhibition game to back starting the season again. And then we had to go from Oakland to Toronto. And when we got to Toronto, that's when everybody was completely wiped out. I mean, I've never seen a more exhausted group in my life. And I'm talking about the players, the staff. Anybody that was on that trip was totally wiped out. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I think we went into Toronto and they swept us in that series. And it took a long time to get over that, especially on the way back. But, you know, once was enough for me. And I got to tell you, you know, they had all kind of rules. First of all, when you go over there, don't sleep. You know, try not to sleep the whole way over there so you'd be on time when you get there. And that was a definitely difficult thing to do on a flight that's that long, you know. And then coming back, stay awake. It was. I mean, to try to sleep, you know, on the way back, it was crazy. But that's the farthest I've ever been on an airplane, and I don't ever want to do that again. You know, nothing against Japan. Japan was great. The whole experience there was very, very good. But it was so tiring. When we got to Toronto, everybody was just absolutely wiped out.
You know, it's funny. We did the London trip last year. The Red Sox Yankees games in London. I got to do that, and we went over there, and the trip, remember, they got that ridiculous plane. It's the most luxurious plane on the planet. Yeah. There's only one.
Yeah, I didn't get to go. You did.
Yeah, it was glorious, Jerry. You should have. Yeah, everybody got a suite. My first apartment wasn't as big as the cabin I had. And we go over there, and we land, and I'll never forget, we were in line at Immigration Customs, and I saw two of the players, like, high-fiving each other, saying, that was so easy. We should come to London all the time. That's not a big deal. Well, London traffic is so bad. It took us 3.5 hours to go 25 miles to the hotel. By the time we got to the hotel, players were angry. They were like, this stinks. I'm never doing this again. The best plans had fallen apart. And speaking, you mentioned Oakland. Red Sox would be wrapping up their West Coast trip right now. Wednesday would have been game 20 of the season, would have wrapped up the West Coast trip. And I was thinking about this morning. Are you paying attention to the schedule at all anymore? Do you find yourself looking to see where they would be in the schedule?
Actually, I'm not. You know, I'm following more what's going on, you know, with these press conferences, with the governor, with the mayor, with the president. I'm following more of that. And, you know, I do realize that Monday would be Marathon Monday in Boston. We'd have the 11 o'clock start across the marathon, and obviously all canceled. I know where we are in the schedule right now, but I don't follow it because I don't know what a schedule is going to look like when we do get back to playing. You know, we don't know. We've heard about Arizona. We've heard about Florida. Now we're back to hearing about Arizona. We've heard about Japan. We've heard everything. And so I don't know what kind of schedule they're going to be able to possibly come up with in any one of those scenarios. But I will say this for them. You know, they're throwing ideas out there, which is good. You know, but they've got to come up with the perfect idea. You know, you can't. This is so critical, I think, to Major League Baseball. And I think that they all know that. They're getting great advice, I'm sure, from the doctors and all the professionals. And, you know, when to start this, when not to start it, and how to try to do it. And then they've got to get, you know, after that point, I believe they're going to have to get permission from the Players Association. Do the players want to do this? And that, I think that's a big question right now, because you're being sequestered from, you know, your family for maybe 4 months or 3 months. I don't think a lot of guys are going to enjoy that very much.
Right. That's the hard part. I thought it was interesting, the one that came up over the weekend. I don't know if you saw this one, where they, instead of an American and National League, there would be a Grapefruit League and a Cactus League. And
right.
That's what you'd have for 2020. You'd play your games in Florida. They'd play their games in Arizona. You never see each other. No interleague play in that respect. And then the Florida winner would play the Arizona winner in the series in a dome, in a neutral site dome. That could be, you know, Tampa Bay in Florida. It could be Chase Field in Phoenix. So that was interesting, because at least in that scenario, you're going back to your spring training facility. It's a place you're comfortable with. Florida would have more challenging travel, the longer bus rides compared to Phoenix. But that was the first one that I said, you know, you might be able to work something out of that, at least until we're ready to go back north.
Yeah, the only problem I see with it, one of the problems I see with it, obviously, is the fact that if you go to Florida now, that you're going to have to obviously make trips to the East Coast. And you know, you're probably going to go over for a 3-game series. You're going to have to stay in hotels over there. And, you know, Florida right now is not in the best situation. I talked to a friend last night who lives down there, and he said it's really starting to hit hard. He says what happened is a lot of people that traveled down from New York when the pandemic got bad in New York came to Florida. And Florida now, right now, is having a very difficult time. So I don't even know if it's feasible or possible. I mean, I agree with you. It'd be more like being home if you were at, you know, JetBlue Park. But the fact is, it's like, how do they manage the logistics of the travel? And, you know, who's cleaning your room? Who's not cleaning your room? And where are you eating? You know, what how are they going to do that stuff? That's all things that are going to go across their plate right now that I'm sure they're dealing with or trying to deal with. I think the first and foremost thing that they're doing right now is just listening to the medical people, you know, and then trying to figure out some kind of idea of how they could possibly do something this season, something, you know, if there is going to be anything at all.
By the way, I don't know if I mentioned this to you yet, and there are much bigger worries, no doubt about that. But did I tell you that my golf clubs are stuck at JetBlue Park right now?
Well, just leave there because you might be back.
That's why I'm hoping they don't go to Arizona. If you're going to play, go to Florida so I can get my golf clubs back.
Yeah, I'm all for that. Yeah, and the fact is, too, is now you go back down there, you'll be doing the same thing all over again. You'll be doing your shows. You'll be doing some games. You'll be doing all this stuff down there. And you'll be playing golf, you know.
Yeah,
so
we'll start from scratch. Yeah, the guys were nice enough because I was shooting to the East Coast to do games with you. We were going to Jupiter and West Palm. Yeah. Then I was going to come back and grab my golf clubs and come home. So they said, yeah, checking out of the hotel, just throw them in the room out back with Tommy McLaughlin and those guys.
That's you, TC. You were way ahead of the curve on this.
Yeah, well, yeah. Now there goes my golf game. But the golf courses are closed anyway, so it doesn't matter. Hey, all this week on Nesson, we are showing the best of David Ortiz. It's a neat way. Last night, Monday night, rather, I was watching the walk-off in 2003. And it was funny to watch him in 2003, you know, skinnier, the short hair. And you forget that when he first came here, he really had to win his playing time. Like Jeremy Giambi was starting ahead of him.
Yeah.
And you forget that he didn't just show up and become Big Poppy. It took time for him to become the player he is.
You're not kidding. And, you know, what a mistake Minnesota made, right? I mean, you know, releasing him, letting him go, allowing us to pick him up. And you're right. When he came here, there wasn't a lot expected out of David Ortiz because, as you said, Giambi was playing first base. He was DHing and all and doing that. And there was no real spot for Ortiz. And then he finally got in the lineup. And, of course, the rest is history. But there's so many great moments, you know. And, we kind of talked a little bit beforehand about, you know, his career. And it's hard for me because there were so many of them to remember, you know, what might be my favorite one. I don't know. But I'm going to tell you a little bit of insight that I used to do every day with David Ortiz and with the Red Sox in particular. It, part of my job as an analyst, I watch batting practice every day. And I kind of get an idea because I think it's very important how guys approach batting practice, the kind of success they have in games. And I watch how guys take it. And he was one of the best I've ever seen at how he takes batting practice. He would start off by hitting a number of balls, maybe 10 balls to left field, 10 up the middle, pull 10, go back the other way, up the middle, and then finish off pulling balls, hit them out of the park. I mean, there was a game plan to everything he did. And he was so consistent in doing that every single day. It impressed me, you know. And he brought that into games with him. I mean, he get the ball out of the ballpark in any place, you know, left field, center field, right field. It didn't matter because he practiced it. He practiced it. It was so, you know, such a great example for young guys coming up to watch how he approached batting practice, you know, and it's kind of a small thing, but it's a big thing to me because it's something I went through as a player.
That's interesting because, you know, you're right, especially when he first came here. Remember what blew us away is his ability to go to opposite field with that power, to be able to drive that up into the Green Monster and up into the seats there. And he continued doing that through his career, but he really started showing ridiculous power, you know, on the pull side over the bullpen. But he could always slap one up off the wall or up into the seat if you tried to pitch him outside.
You know, I've always said that Fenway Park was built for left-handed hitters. And the reason I say that is because you always have that ability for guys that can reach that left field wall to take that swing out of your pocket and use it. And that's a great swing because when you go to the opposite field like that, you know, you're sure you're keeping your shoulder on the ball, your head's on the ball, you're doing everything properly. And that makes a beautiful swing. And for guys like him, like Freddie Lynn, like Yastrzemski, you know, a lot of great parts, all left-handed hitters that hit in this ballpark. I mean, it's a great park for left-handed hitters to hit in. And, you know, but then you got to be big like David Ortiz and some of these other guys to be able to pull the ball here and hit as many home runs as he did. And he hit plenty of them.
You know, the other thing is I think fans look at what he was doing at the end and they think it always came easy for David Ortiz. This is a guy who really had to work at it and almost reinvent himself several times along the way. And I always think of 2009. You know, they'd won the World Series in 07 again. They went to Game 7 of the ALCS in 08. And then in 09, he was really struggling. That was when he was having that brutal April. And I'll never forget, we did a post-game show where we used to do fan question, like a poll for fans. You guys would run it during the game. We'd have the results post-game. And it wasn't about Ortiz. The question was about Mike Lowell. And Mike Lowell wasn't playing much at that point.
Right.
What should Mike Lowell be doing? And overwhelmingly, the fans said he should be the everyday DH.
Right.
And they were done with Ortiz. And if you remember, it was one of those games that we had the results of that poll question. And it was Dustin Pedroia who actually called the media over and said, hey, lay off David Ortiz. Look at what I did last April. I was hitting a .161. What happened after that? Laser show. And that's when Laser Show was born. And
right.
The point was, stick with Ortiz because what he's done. But Ortiz was really struggling, especially against lefties. Like, you started seeing Mike Lowell in the lineup against lefties. And he turned that around. By the end of that season, he was himself again.
Yeah, and one other point in that, too, is he was not happy at all about that because he went into Tito a couple of times and was talking to him about it, not in a very pleasant way. You know, he was very disappointed at the fact that, you know, this poll was going on and people didn't want him to play. And he was sitting at times and Lowell was getting in there. And he was not very happy about it, but he would, you know, to his credit, he took it to work. You know, he took it to work with him, and he became a better hitter and a better player, a more consistent hitter. And that's exactly what, you know, he was the rest of his career. But, you know, almost everybody that's ever played this game goes through spurts like that. And there was always some question about David, you know, because of the way we got him. You know, was he going to be this big superstar? You know, was it going to disappear? You know, because he didn't have a lot of things going on for him in Minnesota. They sent him to the minor leagues for quite a lot. Tom Kelly didn't have much use for him at all. You know, so it was, people were wondering, you know, have we seen the best of him? And all of a sudden, you know, I think that's when it clicked into him, like, you got to come out here and do this every single day. And, you know, I think his work ethic got a little better after that. I think the way that he approached everything got a little better. And, of course, you know, then he became one of these guys that, you know, we always think of the people or athletes, and we'll focus on athletes. When they come into a room, Ted Williams was like that. You know, Muhammad Ali was like that. Bobby Orr, Larry Bird, you know, when they walk into a room, everybody knows they're there. Well, that's the same thing with David Ortiz. When he walked in that clubhouse every day, everybody knew that David was there, you know, and it just turned everything around.
You know, the thing I wanted to ask you about that too is that middle period, because he ended so strong, 2018, he was gone by then. His final season was unbelievable. What was that, 2016? And just an unbelievable last year. But in that middle gap, 09, 10, 11, that was when he didn't have Manny. You know, he'd had Manny hitting with him in the lineup all that time, usually 3-4. And then later, other guys stepped in. Maybe Jason Bay came, but then he was gone. Do you think some of the middle of his career, he was hurt a little bit by the lack of protection behind him?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. You know, that's so important to those big guys in the middle of the lineup. You know, who's hitting behind it? Because, you know, if you don't have anybody back there that's going to be able to do the job, you're not going to see anything to hit. And then you just get into bad habits because, you know, all the pressure's falling on you as an individual. And you have help from nobody behind you. So what you're trying to do is make things happen that are almost impossible to make happen. And you end up swinging at bad pitches. You swing it, you know, your strike zone's not disciplined like it should be. And I think that's one of the things that happened to David, you know, in his career. That combination of Ortiz and Ramirez together may be probably the best that I've ever seen, you know, hitting back-to-back like that. Because, you know, pick your poison, all right? You got to pitch to David because you got one of the best right-handed hitters in the league, if not the best right-handed in the league on deck, and Manny. So it was such a pleasure to watch those guys play. It really was. And I'm really glad Nestor's doing this week, you know, that David Ortiz – you know, features that you're doing, because they've done some great stuff already. I mean, this is stuff I've been watching, and it brings back an awful lot of memories, you know. But to be able to watch Ortiz this week go through his career, that's going to be pretty special.
You go to his last season. I know they're kind of going chronologically, so the last games they're showing in the best of week are his final season, 2016. He hit .315, 127 RBI, and 48 doubles to lead all of baseball. And as you know, because you're in the clubhouse earlier than I am, earlier than anybody except the players themselves, and earlier than some of the players, he was getting, you know, an hour and a half work on his feet and his ankles just to get him into games. Yeah. He was doing hour-long interviews every other day about the end of his career. Yeah. I've always been amazed that he was able to put together one of the great seasons in the history of Red Sox hitters while the world was talking about his retirement and everything going on around him. That could not have been easy.
You know, you're exactly right, TC, and he was physically beaten down, you know, at that point. I think that's obviously the reason that he retired, because he still had plenty of baseball left in my opinion. I mean, he proved that year. But, you know, I think physically it became very difficult for him. And then all that he had to put up with, I mean, he was the go-to guy, you know, for the media, obviously, at that point. You know, everything that he was doing in his final season, and people wanted to know, are you coming back? You want to come back for another year? And, you know, he kept saying, no, this is it, you know. And it was pretty special to watch. And, you know, a lot of guys go out on the bad end of it. You know, he didn't go out on the bad end of it. He went out big time. And that's I enjoy seeing that. I hate to see guys that hang around a little bit too long. And you see a fraction of them, you know, the last year or two that they play. And, you know, we didn't see a fraction of David Ortiz. We saw him put up an incredible season the year that he retired.
And now there's a bridge named after him, and an airplane named after him, and a gate at the Logan
Airport. He's everywhere. Every commercial I see.
Big Poppy, obviously one of the great nicknames in baseball. And you've got to get credit where credit is due, because you were the one who started the whole Big Poppy era. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, when I would go and sit in the clubhouse and he'd come in, guys would call him Poppy. You know, so at that time, I wasn't exactly sure what Poppy meant. Now I know it's, you know, like a father. And, you know, everybody was calling him Poppy. So, you know, he started to have this success. And, you know, I'm looking at the guy. The guy's a monster, for crying out loud. He's huge. So I went up to him one day in the club. I said, David, I said, do you mind if I call you Big Poppy? And he looked at me and he goes, no, I kind of like that, you know. So I said, okay, then I'm going with it tonight. And so from that point on, I started to call him Big Poppy on the air. And that's how we got the, you know, he's still Big Poppy today. So, you know, every time I remind him of that every once in a while, but I haven't seen any checks in the mail.
Nothing. You get nothing for that?
But that's a true story. I mean, I can remember the time I walked right up to the locker and, you know, I'm looking up at him. I said, David, you know, I said, do you mind if I call you Big Poppy? And he looked at me, he goes, oh, man, that's all right, you know. So that started that night, and that's how he became Big Poppy.
That's very funny. You know, the only thing I've got anything close to that is I was the one who named Charlie Moore the Mad Fisherman. Oh, I started calling him the Mad Fisherman on the air. I get nothing. There's Mad Fisherman ice cream, Mad Fisherman spices. There's a Mad Fisherman line of fishing poles. I get nothing. I get a T-shirt once from him.
Well, at least you got the fish with him, though.
I did get the fish with him a couple of times. He's pretty good. Before we wrap up and move on from Ortiz, I just want to ask you, when you look back on his whole time, and we know the accomplishments, the championships, the batting, everything he did. What will you remember most about David Ortiz as a player for the Boston Red Sox?
Well, he was the kind of guy to me that you obviously did not want to miss in at bat. You know, you wanted – it's almost like when Pedro started a game. You didn't want to miss a Pedro or Martinez start. You didn't want to miss a David Ortiz at bat because you never knew what to expect. Every time he came to the plate, he had the presence and the ability to possibly hit a home run. You know, or in big situations, you wanted David Ortiz to play. You wanted him there because you knew that he loved the big moment. And he proved that throughout his career. So for me, it was like a pleasure to just watch him come to the plate every time he did, and especially in big situations, because you just had such a good feeling that something good was going to happen. And he was so clutch. You know, that's the other thing. The harder the environment got, the tougher he got. And that's... There are certain players who shy away from that. Certain players don't want to be in that position where, you know, the game's on the line, I got to do it or I'm going to be the failure. You know, no, it's always the other way around with David Ortiz. He wanted to be in that position because he thought he was going to be the guy that took the club to another victory. And that's what I remember about him.
You know, I did that interview with him at the end. We did the long documentary on his career, and he sat down with me for like an hour and a half, 2 hours. Right at the end of the season of his last year. And it was amazing to me that he said, I asked him, how can you do it? How do you keep your pulse down? How do you, you know, guys get overwhelmed by the moment, even at that level, and you never do. And he said, you know, he's standing in the on-deck circle and think about being a kid in the projects in the Dominican and friends who had been killed and shot and his mother passing away. He used to think of all the bad things that would happen in his life ahead of time. And yeah. Then this is not pressure. You know, getting out of that was pressure. He was always able to put it in perspective so that when he got up to the plate, he wasn't thinking about any of the pressure. He was thinking about, you know, is Benoit going to try to throw me that change up and I'm going to hit a grand slam off it if he does. He was always able to get back to baseball by putting aside the pressure.
That's a great story. That's some great insight from, you know, that you got out of him in that interview, because I had never heard that before. And I, you know, that, you know, there are different ways players motivate themselves, and obviously that's a huge one for David Ortiz. That's very interesting to hear.
So finally, as we wrap it up, what are you up to these days? You watching anything new on television? What do you got?
You know what I did? I binge-watched The Crown over the last weekend. My wife and I sat here and watched all of that and watched how Prince Philip, or whatever his name is, I don't know, the one that could be the king next.
Yeah.
Man, he had a brutal upbringing. I, what a what a life living in that castle. I mean, unbelievable. Like, I can see why Harry and Meghan took off, because, I mean, I just don't understand how anybody could do it. It's crazy. But we've been doing stuff like that. We've been trying to find stuff on TV to do, you know, and we're basically Sydney, and my wife's afraid to go out too, because, you know, she doesn't want to bring something back to me. So, you know, since spring training, we've been locked in the house. I get out every morning for a little drive for about 10 or 15 minutes. That's about it, you know, and we're just trying to find things to do around the house. But you know what? It is what it is, and we'll make the best of it. We're trying to make the best of it, and hopefully soon, and, you know, sometime in the future, we can all get back to our normal lives. And, you know, it's one of the strangest things and one of the scariest things I think I've ever been through in my life.
Well, I don't understand it, because we're in it now. You know, now is when you watch the nightly news and they're talking about thousands of new cases, hundreds of deaths. I mean, we're in the peak of it right now. And you said it beautifully last week, Jerry. But again, we can't say it enough. Thank you to all the men and women on the front lines at the hospitals and the clinics and the ones out there fighting, the scientists who are trying to come up with a cure. And I'll even say, you know, to the kids working at grocery stores and the people bagging groceries and working at pharmacies and you know, they're literally putting themselves in harm's way to just try to keep some of society going. It's we've never seen anything like this in our lives.
Yeah, that's a great point, TC. And, you know, I just mailed out about 250 cards to Mass General. I sent it to a certain doctor there who hopefully will distribute to people that he seems fit to distribute to. It just wrote a little message in there, hopefully to, you know, pick their spirits up for maybe a minute in the day, you know. So they just went on the mail today. They should probably get them by tomorrow. And, you know, you talk about people in the supermarkets. My sister, for example, is a manager in a supermarket down in Florida. I think about her every day. You know, she's involved in, she's right in the middle of things every single day, but she's fine. So, you know, if she's fine, I'm good. So, but, you know, but it's, I remember 9/11, and that was so shocking, but this is so scary because you just don't know where it is and where it's coming from and how you can get it and where you can get it from. And it's really scary, scary stuff.
Yeah. The other thing about 9/11 too, is it was the aftermath. It was over. We were getting right back to life here. We don't know when it's going to end. And I think that's what's, I mean, you've dealt with some depression and anxiety, and a lot of people are battling that stuff right now, Jerry.
They certainly are. Look, when you're out of work and you're not getting a paycheck, and there's so many people out there right now in that situation, and you don't know where you're going to be able to pay your rent, you don't know where you're going to be able to buy food, that's pressure. And that you know, they kind of laughed a little bit at the president. You know, I'm not being politically here one way or the other, but they kind of laughed at the beginning when he said, you know, there's going to be a lot of depression coming out of this. And it's so true, because it's things like this that, you know, bring you into a funk, you know, and you got to try to find things to keep yourself occupied, to do stuff, to try to keep some kind of sanity. And that's why I go for a little bit of a ride in the morning, just to change the environment that I'm in for a short period of time. But there's so many people out there struggling right now. It's just so sad.
Yeah, it really is. And you go anywhere good lately on a ride? You find anywhere new?
Got
a new
What's route? That?
On your rides, have you got a new route anywhere in your car?
I found a nice spot right on the Lincoln Sudbury line, and it's kind of like an inlet to a bunch of trails. And I kind of pull in there, and what I do is I read the papers on my phone every morning. I sit there, read. I go through Nesson.com, I go through RedSox.com, MLB.com, The Globe. I go through all those, and then I turn around and I come home when I'm done reading them. So it's a new place for me to read the paper, but it's kind of peaceful.
Yeah, and that's what we're all looking for. You know what I mean? Just a place to calm. And, you know, I got a bike. I can get out a little more than you. So I haven't had a bike in 20 years. I bought a bike. It got delivered. Now I go for a bike ride. I go 20 miles in the morning and just get outside. And
20 miles. That's all you're doing? What's the matter with you?
Easing up. You know, we're building up. Right? Last thing I want. Well, you know what you do? I mean, you don't want to, like, fall and roll your ankle. You end up in the hospital for a stupid rolled ankle. And then
they won't let you in.
I know. You'll be at the DCU Center getting your ankle fixed in the middle of the arena. All right. So that's actually another quick half hour. Good stuff today on Big Poppy. Thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate you guys all coming on the show this week. It was fun.
That was fun. We had a lot of fun this morning. And this is going great. I enjoy it.
This has been fun. And I'm telling you, look up the mannequins and the robots on the Tiger
Woods baseball. I'm going to check that out.
I'll send you a picture. You're going to laugh. It's beautiful.
All right.
All right, Jerry. Good stuff. We'll do it again next week.
All right, TC, take care.
All right, that's Jerry Remy. I'm Tom Karen. Thanks for watching or listening to the TC and Jerry podcast. See you next time.